still under it. Leroy is still sick. And then Dick McGrady had a trach put in on Monday, I believe, and a feeding tube. And there has not been any noticeable response in the past 2 weeks on his part. So continue to pray for him. And then Brian Brinker had a drain put in his stomach area. Still in the hospital as far as we know, but getting closer to coming home. I have no fresh information on Shirley Acerny. Yeah. Anything else from you folks?
I have an update from my nephew.
Austin?
Well, Austin was at Children's Hospital yesterday, and they did through the vein in his leg up to his left side of his brain. And the doctor said he could not find anything more than what they had seen on the MRI. Everything on the left side. But they're sending him to a specialist at UPMC in Pittsburgh, Tennessee. And he may have to have if it's not influence radiation on the arteries. But the arteries and veins are not going into the capillaries. Instead of that, they were coming together and they were leaking. And I said, when did this happen? And she said it's the first thing that he's always had. And they're just not discovered because he had his seizures. He's on seizure medicine. And he's okay.
Okay.
So that's the next step. They may have to do what they call change for medication. Seal that, keep it from leaving because you should have to stay.
All right. Anyone else? Okay. Pray for Steve Smith and his family. They got a little emotional turmoil today. And he called asking that you might remember him tonight. If you would give some assist to him and Bonnie and the kids. Anyone else now? I think we've got everybody squared away. All right. Let's begin with a word of prayer. I'd like to just comment to begin with out of James chapter 5. One of the things that we didn't get time to complete on Sunday night was concerning the Christian addict. The third thing that they need to be is prayerful. And leaped upon this place in the scripture, James 5 and 13th verse. Is any among you afflicted? Let him pray. And then verse 15. And the prayer of faith shall save the sick. And in verse 16. Confess your faults one to another and pray one for another that you may be healed. The effectual fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. It certainly is consistent with what I believe our church is all about when it concerns itself with the needs and the burdens that others bear, and that we would count it a great privilege to seek the enablement of God in prayer to maintain meaningful contact with our brethren and be able to come alongside of them, that we might help shoulder their burdens, and we might addict ourselves to the ministry of the saints of God. But tonight, this matter of the earnest, fervent prayer of a righteous man speaks about prevailing prayer. And I just want to give you, to begin with, a little bit of a definition, homemade definition of this matter of prevailing prayer, and then seek to illustrate that by the highlighting the characteristics of a dog, a certain kind of dog. And that definition, before we get there, of prevailing prayer arises out of a conviction that clings with bulldog tenacity to the promises of God and is fully persuaded of His willingness to apply His omnipotent power on our behalf. Prevailing prayer is born in the mindset of a person with that disposition. Now, there's an illustration of tenacity that I want for you to see in 2 Samuel chapter 2. In 2 Samuel chapter 2. And while you're turning there, let me just share with you some personal information, probably unknown to everybody except my wife, that as a junior high school student, way back when, I met for the first time an unusual person that, when I first laid eyes on him, stood about this high, about right like this. And he had the countenance about him that it didn't exactly endear him to anyone. And I think it was probably days after being with him this period of time. It was several days before I ever learned what his real name was. But as he came to Freeport, he moved up from Butler Junction. Now, Butler Junction, for those of you who are familiar with the Freeport area, is that little village that sits on the hillside coming down the Freeport Hill, right up above the Buffalo Creek. And at that time, it was sort of like you've heard of people speak about the other side of the tracks. Well, it was a neighborhood that was underneath the other side of the tracks. Okay? So here he comes, and he has this way about him. And the unique thing about him was, when I first met him then, he was this high, as I said, and one thing hasn't changed about him. He's still this high. He never grew. Never grew. The height that he was when we first met is the exact height that he is today. And something else hasn't changed about him over the years is that he lives up to his nickname. And to just to illustrate that, when we were working our way through, and I say working tongue-in-cheek, through the junior high school academic rigors and high school rigors, one thing he could do was really play football. Don't think he ever weighed more than 165 pounds at his meatiest. And he played unbelievably offensive guard on one side and then nose tackle on the other side. And one of the things that spoke well of him was that in his position for the years that we played together, I never saw anybody move him. Never saw anybody move him, and Lord knows they tried. Sometimes double teaming, sometimes triple teaming. He never was moved. As a result, after practice or a game, take his hat off, and he's got lacerations here. He's got lacerations here, because the only thing that moved on him was his hat, and his hat didn't fit exactly right. But his name was Bulldog, and he had a disposition in many other respects of being stubborn, really dug in on things, stubborn, sometimes to a fault. You have an illustration here in a young man's name by the name of Asahel, who was very bulldog-like in his pursuit of the enemy general. At this particular time in 2 Samuel, David is being reinstituted as king. Saul is dead. But there's a difference of opinion. Difference of opinion. Beginning at the 8th verse, you see Abner. He's the general that led Saul's army. And when they determined that David was going to be king in Judah, Abner, he took Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and he basically led the opposing movement to install Saul's son as the king. And so he did that. And in verse 10, Ishbosheth's Saul's son was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel and reigned 2 years. Actually, there was a 7.5 year period of time. It took him about 5 years to consolidate all the clans of Israel and only ruled over them in unison for this particular 2 year period of time. But at the same time, David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah and was 7 years, 6 months. Now, verse 12 says, Abner, the son of Ner, and the servants of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David went out and met together by the pool of Gibeon. Now, archaeologists have uncovered that site, and the reason that they met there was because it was located on the border. And so here's the picture. You have Saul's general, Abner, David's general, Joab, and the opposing armies meet together at the pool of Gibeon. Now, the pool itself was not much in diameter, but it was very deep, something like, they say, 82 to 90 feet deep. And there's one army on this side, one army on this side. Now, I want you to see here in the text what hasn't changed in the century since. Verse 14. Abner said to Joab, let the young men now arise and what? Play. Now, the word play is actually a term that involves, in all actuality, mortal combat. Please notice what hasn't changed. Old men pick fights and send young men to die in them. Abner said, the general said, let the young men now arise, play before us. Actually, what they're setting up is a scene much like was true of David and Goliath. You remember Goliath kept coming after Israel and saying, send me your champion and we'll fight. And basically the motive was, if just two guys fight, we can avoid widespread bloodshed. And the same premise is here. Send 12 of your best, I'll send 12 of my best, and winner take all. That will prevent the entire armies from being engaged in the bloodshed. Now, to get off on a rabbit trail just a minute, I point out to you again that while that has not changed in the centuries since then, old men still pick fights, young men still die in the fight. And I would say that probably the quick solution to conflict anywhere in the world is a universal global requirement that would have the old men who picketh the fight stand front in line and lead the way into the fight. And I guarantee you that the conflicts would show a marked decline in every place around the world. However, that's not going to happen. So basically what he's saying, you give me 12, I'll give 12 and send them down in there and let them have at it. Okay? Now, what happens? Verse 16 says, they caught every one his fellow by the head and thrust his sword in his fellow's side, so they fell down together. All 24 young men died. What happens next? In verse 17, there was a very sore battle that day. So 24 men died. That precipitated an extremely intense battle in which Abner, Saul's general, lost. Now enter the characteristic of a bulldog tenacity that ought to characterize your prayer life and mine. Please notice what happens. Verse 18. Asahel was as light of foot as a wild roe. Translated into modern English, he was quick of foot and very fast. Okay? And what does he do? Abner is on the run. And he pursues him. And verse 19 says, in going, he turned not to the right hand nor to the left from following Abner. He would absolutely refuse to be distracted. Absolutely refuse. Then Abner looked behind him. And he said, art thou Asahel? And he answered, I am. Isn't it a sad thing when the enemy that you pursue knows your identity? Sort of like what may have transpired at different times in the Civil War, where neighbors fought against neighbors, some cases family members against family members, and with lethal consequences. That's a shame. That's a dirty shame. Anyway, he wouldn't turn. And verse 21, Abner said to him, turn thee aside to the right hand or to the left. Lay thee hold on one of the young men, one of the dead ones, and get his armor. Because Asahel was pursuing without protection. And being as much as Abner was a skilled warrior, Asahel's an easy mark. He's totally vulnerable. But please notice the bulldog determination by this man who would not be distracted by anything, even risking his personal well-being. He would not turn aside from following him. And Abner said again to Asahel, turn thee aside from following me. This is the second request. And why should I smite thee to the ground? How then should I hold up my face to Joab, thy brother? Abner was familiar with the family line here. And he did not want to kill this young man. He kept running, and with bulldog determination, Asahel continued to pursue him. Please notice again, verse 23. Second request to come in, howbeit he refused to turn aside. Wherefore Abner, with the hinder end of his spear, smote him under the fifth rib, that the spear came out behind him, and he fell down there, and he died. Now, I'd bring it to that point to say that the death was certainly unfortunate, and probably Asahel unwise, but yet he, with great determination, pursued the enemy and would not stop until he had acquired or had completed his mission. Didn't end the way he wanted to, but that did not deter him. And may I say to you that probably him, like most soldiers, they have no notion of what the end is going to be, and yet undauntingly they pursue their mission in the hopes that it will turn out well. And sometimes it doesn't. It doesn't. Now, that's the kind of a disposition that ought to characterize our prayer life. That's the kind of a disposition that we find associated with prevailing prayer. That righteous man of James 5 accomplishes much through prevailing prayer. Now, to me, that's all amazing and great, great sample. But let me have you come to Joshua 10, one of the greatest chapters in the Bible. And I'm going to show you just how much God may accomplish through prayer. Joshua 10. Joshua 10. Now the Amorites were a people. Before, when I start reading some of this, you may think, the Lord didn't cut anybody slack when he sicked his army on them. And understand that the Amorites were an incredibly horrible, wicked people, and very infectious. And God had ordered their extermination. Okay? So what we read in verse number 10 is the Lord discomfited them before Israel, slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon. Remember now, we were at the pool of Gibeon in the last account. He slew them with a great slaughter. Now, I just want to stop and say to you that when there is this mention of a great slaughter, someone might say, well, why wasn't that sufficient? A great slaughter. Well, the reason it wasn't sufficient was because there were still some living Amorites. And God had ordered their extermination. You say, well, you know, when there's a great slaughter, the prevailing emotion is that whenever you see the dead bodies and the blood, and when you smell the death, and when you hear the sounds of the dying, and when you see the horror of it all, you're inclined to think with that great slaughter, enough's enough. And those who can escape, let them go. What can they possibly do? Well, understand the ancient culture of the day, that there was such a bloodthirst that the survivors one day likely would return and take vengeance on these men. For that reason, God ordered their extermination. Now, the problem that Joshua and his people had, well, they were running out of time. Because as soon as night fell, it would be easy for the enemy to escape into the night. Please notice what happens. They fled from before Israel. And what did God do? He sent hailstones. And I want you to understand this about sovereign prerogative. God slew more with hailstones than he did in combat. And note this too, there was not one single casualty, not one single casualty listed among Joshua's people. Now, you understand the concept or the terminology that is sometimes you hear in the news about friendly fire and the tragic consequences of that. When, either by accident or by design, the overwhelming rush of the enemy has to be dealt with either with artillery or mortar fire or jet aircraft, where they have to drop ordnance in such a position as to eliminate the onrushing, overwhelming enemy, but military tacticians will say in a circumstance that we can count on losing some of our own, but so long as the entire body is preserved, justifiable. And so the order is carried out and the ordnance is dropped. And the enemy is defeated, but in the process of that, some of our own are casualties. Sad part of war. And here you have the instance where not one single friendly was a casualty. But that did not solve the problem. The enemy was about to escape and there was not enough time. And so what does Josh do in verse 12? He prays. Remember, the earnest fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. 10:12. Then spake Joshua to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel. Now catch this prayer. Sun, stand thou still upon Gibeon, and thou moon in the valley of Ajalon. And the sun stood still, and the moon stayed until the people had avenged themselves upon their enemies. Is not this written in the book of Jasher? So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven and hasted not to go down a whole day. Now here's what God did in prayer. Here's what God did in prayer. Now I'm not a scientist or the son of a scientist. I never took an interest in school and in those things. That was just sort of something you passed through on the way to your diploma. Regrets. But what God did was gradually decelerate the Earth's rotation. Gradual deceleration of the Earth's rotation and brought it to a halt. Because the sun typically is said by scientists not to move unless you speak in terms of relative positioning. But the Earth came to a stop for a whole day. And he did it gradually because had he done it suddenly or abruptly, there probably would have been catastrophic earthquakes and disruptions and like that all over the place. But it was a gradual deceleration, allowing the troops of Joshua to take vengeance on every one of the Amorites, giving them the daylight that they needed to do that. And when it was over, he gradually accelerated Earth's rotation once again. Now, this fact, this occurrence, is phenomenal in the sense that there are at least, aside from the book of Jasher, the book now lost, but there are in the historical accounts of people in different placements on the globe, no collusion at all, no possible way of collusion, notations in the record of the event occurring in their day. And when you have all the documents in front of you, it is this exact same day where this occurred. And not there is absolutely no dispute, even among secular scientists or Christian scientists, about the factuality of it. And the only reason I point out to you is this, that the tenacity on the part of Joshua and his soldiers to obey the orders of God to exterminate the Amorites required of them something that they had no control over. Now, the lesson for us is this. When we come to prayer, sometimes we come to it in the circumstances that we find are outside of our control. And we learn here in this lesson that God is able to do this, and He is able to do so much more. Come to Him in prayer with bulldog tenacity, knowing that everything that can be done was done, and now everything is outside of my reach, beyond my control, and it's now totally in the hands of God. And I say that the God who made the earth stop for that period of time is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think or even can understand. And so I just leave you with this thought. Prevailing prayer arises out of a conviction that clings with that bulldog tenacity to the promises of God and is fully persuaded of His willingness, God's willingness, to apply His omnipotent power on your behalf. When you have that conviction, you have that kind of tenacity as you approach prayer.